Welcome to 21 Grams Speaks, the podcast where I, Dennis, the creator of 21 Grams, chat with my talented friends about a wide range of topics from mental health, addiction, and recovery to religion and politics. We dive into honest conversations to broaden our perspectives and share them with you. Thank you for joining us as we explore the complexities of these subjects, bringing you thought-provoking insights. I'm Dennis, your host, and this is 21 Grams Speaks. What's up, guys? This is Dennis from 21 Grams. We are starting the second season of the podcast. Going to kind of switch it up a little bit, and we're going to just have conversations with my friends. I'm really, really fortunate that I have really talented friends, very unique people that I get to talk to on a regular basis, and I just want to bring that to the foreground. I'm really excited about today's first guest and co-host. If you don't mind, Wyatt, why don't you introduce yourself, kind of give a little bit of a background, and we'll just start talking shit.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Wyatt Cutchin. I'm the owner of Village Water Blades. I do that as a part-time thing, but my real job is I'm in the United States Navy, and I've been in the Navy for 10 years and 22 countries, and I've had a very traveled life, and I'm very fortunate for all of it, I suppose.
That's awesome. If you guys, this is only an audio podcast, but if you go to his Instagram and see a photo of him, he looks exactly like Navy. Like if you were to look up the word Navy, this dude looks just like him in the best way possible. Yeah. You're a Navy guy.
You should, just see my tattoos. Like my feet are done. Like I got like hand tattoos on like hold fast. And, you know, like,
do you have the pig and rooster on your feet?
Yeah.
Of course you do.
Yeah. As like traditional both, like, as it gets. My entire foot is covered in tattoos.
That's awesome. They hurt those, tattoo things.
Oh, they were horrible. It was a terrible experience. And I made a huge mistake, and I went and I got both of my feet done. And then I went directly to a ship and sat on that boat for like 6 months. So like my healing process was I was on board a boat.
Just getting them both done at the same time is miserable. Then being in the circumstance where you have to be on a boat for 6 months, that's rough, man.
It was terrible. Yeah, I was a really bad decision to get them done at that point in time.
What do you think has been the most painful tattoo that you've gotten so far? I know that's kind of a cliche question, but I get asked it all the time. Your feet?
I think they're all terrible.
They all are.
I've never had a tattoo where I'm like, oh man, that was really enjoyable. No, they all suck.
They all suck.
In my opinion, people who come up to me and they're like, oh man, I love getting tattoos. It feels so good. I don't understand those people. And I never
because they're liars and I don't trust them. I don't trust them. They're liars. There's no chance that they're telling the truth.
Yeah. I immediately stopped talking to that person.
Yeah, I have trust issues with people like that. I think the worst ones that I got have been the palm of my hand, which was brutal in the healing process as well, other than the back of my kneecap. I got to work with like an old timer, one of like the Southern California like legends, Rick Walters, and he tattooed the back of my kneecap. Awesome dude, but man, they tattooed different back then, and he just kept it going. Like, it hurt.
They're a lot.
Still hurts.
Like they're the old timer tattoo artists. They're a lot more aggressive, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, I got the back of my leg done too, and like, I'm probably like a good like 4 inches from the back of my knee, and like even that was starting to get really bad. So I couldn't even imagine getting the back of your knee done.
Oh yeah, that, and I have a tattoo of a little like campfire under my one of my butt cheeks, and that hurt real bad. And it was supposed to be like, you know, lighting a fire under my ass and, you know, getting that grind on. And that was painful, man. They all suck, though. They all suck.
They're all terrible. They're all terrible.
I haven't been tattooed in a really long time. I don't know if you know. I think we talked about this. Just to give the listeners a little background, me and Wyatt met about almost a year ago, right? Roughly a year ago, there was a Southern California makers meetup. And fortunately, me and Wyatt got to sit next to each other while we were eating barbecue. It was pretty awesome. Yeah. We broed out immediately.
Yeah, it was cool. That was a really cool experience. And then I also kind of, I felt like kind of like an outlier there. because I'm like the only knife maker, and then everybody else is like leather makers and stuff. And you're all like geeking out about like leather stuff. I'm just like, I'm like, yeah, that's neat.
I felt a little, I don't know if it was an outlier, but I felt a little bit guilty because I didn't know a lot of the people that were there. And not to say, it's just, I don't social media. Yeah, I just like, I post my stuff and run. Like, I don't really like, there's a handful of people that I talk to on a regular basis, but like, I always feel guilty when people are familiar with my work and I'm not with theirs. And there's people that I like have long extended conversations with through Messenger. And then I go like to look at their stuff and I'm like, oh my God, I'm not even following you. And you're my friend. Like, I just don't even like put two and two together. Like, I don't know. It was awesome. I won a bunch of free stuff. And then I ended up giving it away. I forget the guy's name. The guy that owns Orange Leather Good came out and
he was there. Actually, I don't remember his name either, but his photography and his work looks super like clean and crisp. Actually, really like
he's rad.
He presents his stuff. Yeah.
We ended up going and getting sushi that day too, and he was just super fun to hang out with. And I feel like in Southern California, especially when it comes to leather craft, like I just imagine like leather craft being popular like in Texas or like the South, or you know what I mean? I just don't imagine Southern California.
Yeah, like flyover states.
Yeah, exactly. Like the red states. And being from Southern California and not having a style like anybody else's, I always have this like stereotype in my head. Every time I talk to like a leather crafter, that I'm talking to some like super conservative, like, you know, whatever. I'm not going to use derogatory terms, just people that are the opposite of me. And it turns out the majority of the time, one, people don't care or that like they don't even follow it, or two, they're just like me. And I'm always like, dude, all of these stereotypes that I put up in my own head, I'm doing the same thing. Like, it's just, it's crazy. But yeah, that was a really fun event. I would love to get together and get like that same group of people and even do it here. Like, we have a rad backyard and my leather shop's here, and we can barbecue and do some, you know, hold hands and do some cannonballs together and stuff like that.
Kumbaya it up.
Hell yeah, have a bonfire. So you said that you're doing your knife business, but you're also full-time Navy. How is that? Yeah. How are you able to balance that, your family life, your friends, your social life, you know, relationships, all of that kind of stuff? Because that's a lot.
It's incredibly challenging, if I'm being honest with you. It's super hard. So I work in the Navy probably like 50 to, I'd say roughly 50-ish hours a week is probably what I do in the Navy.
That's so intense.
And it's not even like, I don't want to like put down like people who do like office jobs, because like that's hard work doing like
it's some a office job.
Jobs. But like, sure. I'm like outside on a flight line, like fixing helicopters and dealing with like flight schedule and a whole bunch of stuff. And
it's a different line of work, I'm sure. It's physical rather than just, and it's physical and mental.
Right. So I'm an electrician.
Okay.
Like, I fix helicopters. Like, I'm an aviation electrician. Like, that's like my primary job. But yeah, so I think the most difficult part is just kind of in doing all that is honestly it's kind of taking time for yourself as well. Because I come home and I probably put like 2 or 3 hours into the knife business each night. And then on the weekends, I work probably 8 a.m. to just whenever I'm done on Saturday. And I try to make Sunday for like my wife and my, you know, my personal life. I try to do some, like give Sunday to my wife and just really focus on her.
Yeah.
So you really got to take at least, I don't know, it's like super hard to balance it. And like sometimes like I'll neglect like my friends. I won't see them because like, you know, in the military there's a lot of going aways, a lot of, you know, coming, like seeing people that just came back from deployment, you know.
Yeah.
I try to go out with my friends maybe once or twice a month, and then I really try to give Sundays to my wife and my family. But
that's super valuable. That's something that I really have a hard time with too. I mean, I do what I'm doing full time, but one, I admire how much work you're able to put out doing it, the 1 hour a day plus only Saturday. Like you're pumping stuff out, not just that, but you're pumping out content, which I admire. That's crazy.
That's a whole nother like
job. Like it's a job.
Getting into like your like doing your social media too. And I feel like people kind of neglect that side of it sometimes. Like I know like there's like really amazing like makers, they're really good. But they'll you know, they haven't decided to put the time into like their social media, like getting good at photography, like staging their products and like actually promoting themselves. Because I was like that too. Like every time back when I first got started, I was just like holding a knife in my hand, like a cell phone shot. Like, look guys, look what I made. Or like my feet would be in the photos, or like it'd be oversaturated or just blown out by the sun, you know?
Sure.
But like, yeah, getting good at photography and like social media was also like, that was a huge challenge.
I think it's a challenge. It's a challenge for everyone. I'm the same way. Like if you go back to the beginning, and I think it should be that way. If you go back to anyone that's making this, you know, their life, it's not, it graduates from kind of it graduates from the hobbyist side of things into the like real life. I mean, you're doing it as a business, yeah. You're selling things. You start seeing this progression. I know for myself, when I was just getting started, I would take photos on top of my cutting mat with all of the like lines, you know, like you've seen a cutting mat, like there's all the lines. Right. And that's the first thing that when I talk to people to like up their like photo game, not that I'm great at photo, like I feel like I'm better at video than I am photo, but getting rid of
really
them.
Really well put together.
Thanks, man. I appreciate really that. It's a lot of work.
Like, mine's just like look at the side. Like I like rotate it around, and, like try to hit like get the angles to gleam and some type of lighting.
It's difficult, and it's. I mean, if we're talking about social media, man, that I get so in. I enjoy the video making process and the editing and the sound and all of that kind of stuff. But after I do two or three videos, I just want to go to work for like a couple of days. I just want to listen to a podcast, because when I'm doing video, I have to turn off the AC in my shop, all of the fans, the radio, or if I'm listening to the news or podcasts, I can't have any of that background noise, and it gets hot in there. And it's just, some days I just don't want to do that. I don't want to be in front of a camera. I don't want to try to get the lighting right. And cause it slows down the whole process. So that's just something that it's, you know, it can be tricky, but you do, I mean, if you're trying to make it a business, you have to focus on social media. It just is. Right.
I actually batch out. So I do batch content.
Okay. That's what I figured. Like, yeah.
So odds are, like, if you see a knife that I posted, like I posted one on Monday, I think, and I finished that knife like 2 weeks ago.
Like, yeah.
And so like that's how I do it. So like I'll finish 12, like I do batches of 12, like 10 to 12. And then basically I'll take a weekend. You can't see all the, like, I set up my whole photography.
Right.
Like set up, like I have a bunch of props because like, you know, I stage it.
Sure.
And then I'll get like 5 photos per knife at different angles, whatever it is I'm doing, and I'll batch content. All of it, like I'm good for like posts for like the next like 6 weeks.
That in itself is a skill. I've tried to do that. I've tried to make stuff in batches. I'm trying to start this second company, which is it's called Red Door Leather Co. And it's basically
we spoke about that actually.
Yeah, it's like a less expensive version of the products that I make, and it's rather than hand sewn, it's machine sewn, and I can make
getting fully hand carved sandals.
No, no, because that's the problem that I have is to make a pair of those sandals. It takes me 3-4 days. I'm videoing it, and I need to be able to make some kind of, I need to make money, like straight up, right? Like if I'm going to do this and I want to scale, I can teach somebody to use my sewing machine. I can't teach them to draw and carve and tool and paint the same way that I can without like an extensive education program, which I'm totally open to doing. I want to get an apprentice, but who wants to come to work for free to learn a skill that, you know what I mean? It's not super, like, it's hard to sell that, you know?
I am actually super fortunate. I just got an apprentice who
That's
works with me
rad.
on Saturdays. Yeah, one of my very good friends from work. He was my apprentice at work. Actually, I taught him how to work on helicopters,
Oh,
and
nice.
now I'm teaching him how to make knives.
That's rad.
But
That's
I'm
super
kind of doing the
rad.
same thing you do, like Red Door. So my custom work, which is like the hand done everything, super intricate handles, right?
Right.
Not everybody. And I'm expensive. I'm
I'm
expensive.
expensive. It's okay. It's
Like
okay.
my, like if you want to trick out like a my one of my models, like a jackrabbit with like Damascus steel and like a super intricate segmented handle and like all this stuff, like you're gonna be paying probably 500 plus for that
Yeah.
knife. And
I think that's fair.
I wanted to offer something a bit more reasonable to the people who don't want to spend that. Sorry. So I actually started doing some batch work for like I wouldn't say cheap materials. They're still
More
really high
affordable.
quality materials. Just more affordable processes, right?
Right.
Like my buddy, I'll plug him, Dagger and Knot. He does CNC work, so I hired him to CNC me out a batch of knives with handles and kydex sheaths, and I can offer that at a $300 price point versus if you were to do the same thing but a custom and I'm doing it all by hand, like it's a $420 knife, but I can offer it to you guys or to my clients for
Right.
$300 instead because it's a less time intensive thing because that's what it is. You're buying my time essentially.
That's totally how it is. And I mean, I guess the hard part I have with doing the like more production style work with Red Door is I get bored so easy. Like there are days like I dedicate usually
Yeah.
like one day a week to knock out maybe, you know, six or seven wallets, which is great because in the same way, like I sell like a custom carved and painted wallet for anywhere between like a men's wallet, it's going to be like $300 for like traditional tattoo style work. If it's a portrait, it's going to be more like 400. Then a woman's wallet, it's, you know, up to $900 for like a portrait on a woman's wallet, which is crazy pricing. I can't afford it, but I can't afford to charge any less. But if I do the same
Right.
model and I stitch it with a sewing machine, and it's not as like it's just not as refined, right? Like I still want to be able to make products for the people that want to support me but can't afford it. Like if you were making
Right.
the stuff that I was making and I couldn't afford it, you are my friend, I still want to buy it from you, and you offer something that's less expensive, that's what I'm going to get because I'm buying you, right? Like
Right. That's what it is.
That's
Yeah.
what it
That's
is. You're buying a product from your friend and or a person that you just follow on social media, and you want to, you know, you feel some kind
you
of
just really
connection to
connect with
them.
like that person's story or
Right.
their business model, whatever it is you like about that person. But yeah, that's like the what I was getting at with the production knives. That's why I call them my production knives.
Right.
Is they're just not 100% handmade by me.
Right.
They're probably 15% finished by me.
Right.
Because I just don't have the time to keep up with the output that people are wanting. Like I have people reach out to me all the time, and I feel bad because I'm like I would love to do your project for you, but I don't have the time to dedicate, unfortunately, to you at the moment. Talk to me in
Right.
6 months, and hopefully I have an opening.
Right. Well, yeah, I totally get that because I've been trying to jam you up for a year for a Japanese skiving knife, and you're like, yeah. Then, you know, here we are a
I
year later.
know.
I mean,
I feel so bad.
if I had any feelings at all, you probably would have hurt one or two of them.
It's like my uncle. My uncle wants me to make a chef's knife for my aunt, and I'm like,
Yeah.
I'm trying to fit him in. I'm like, I'm
Well,
so sorry. I
I
have people who've
think,
been waiting for 7 months. So it's like,
yeah.
you know, it's their turn.
I get it. I think the hard part too is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know this is the hard part for me sometimes, is if it isn't part of your catalog and it isn't something that you do regularly, it's more time consuming to prototype something because you're going to make mistakes. That's how it is for me. If someone's like, do you do custom work? I'm like, I do custom designs on my catalog. But if you want something that's specific, you're not, it's too expensive because it's 2 days of prototyping that I have to do just for your project before I feel confident to actually make the final one that I'm going to make to send out to you because I care about the work that I put out. And some people get it, some people don't, but there's a lot of there's a lot of freedom and a lot of good things come from learning how to say no. And it's a really beneficial thing to be able to be like, hey, I'm sorry, that's not what I do.
Yeah, so I have people reach out to me for custom designs. Like they want, you know, just something that I don't do regularly. If you look at my stuff, you'll notice that they're all the same models. Like I do, I have 6 models that I stick to unless I go out of my way to prototype on my own time, which if I do prototyping on my own time, it's usually for a friend or like a close relative.
You said so doo-doo. Like, hey,
I did say doo-doo, you're right. I didn't know if you caught that, but yeah, I don't do custom designs anymore just because like you said, they're very time consuming and some people don't understand that because like, oh, what do you mean? It's the same steel. It just has a different shape. I'm like, yes, but there's different angles I have to do. There's just stuff that goes into it that the general people who don't do this don't see.
That's the whole point right there. That's what I was thinking immediately. Like it's always the people that don't do what you're doing that thinks it's so easy for you to do something different. And if it's that easy, do it yourself. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. But it isn't. Like you're the one that's put all of your time into.
I've had this conversation with so many people. They're like, oh, so yeah. Because I'm a stock removal knife maker. I live in San Diego.
You know,
like I don't have the outside space for a forge and like all this forging equipment. Because forging equipment's huge, like anvil, hammers, whatever it is, right? It's massive. Right. So I'm a stock removal guy, and people are like, oh, so you just get steel and sharpen it? I'm like, yeah, man, that's what I do.
Yeah, it's that easy. You do it.
Yeah, I implore you. Please try it.
Yeah. I think that that's also what people don't understand because handmade products are expensive. Like people are shocked at me or, you know, shocked when they ask me how much a pair of sandals are and I tell them $500 and they're like, oh my God. Like, I'm like, what were you thinking that they would be? Because it's hard. Like it's hard to do what I'm doing and people, oh, I could get them done from somebody else. I'm like, listen, man, if you have someone that can do them cheaper than me, let me know so that I can hire them. If they're as good as I am at what I'm doing, then let me hire them because I could pay them less than what I charge. But that's not how it works. Or you're like, hey, well, what about the cost of this machinery or the utilities?
Yeah. I was going to bring that up. I was like, it's not just my time. I was like, if people knew how much my equipment cost.
Oh, crazy.
Like my grinder, my belt grinder alone, $4,000.
Yeah.
My heat treating oven was $2,500. You know what I mean? Like I have an air compressor set up with like a sandblasting cabinet to do certain things. And that's another $2,000.
And you can't.
Sandpaper alone, I buy $700 of sandpaper every 3 months.
Holy shit. That's crazy. See, I don't even know that. And I make handmade.
But still.
I make handmade goods and that's the thing. And what I think people don't realize is that you don't just go to the store one weekend and buy an entire shop, no matter what it is that you do. You start off with the absolute cheapest version of a tool that you can get. Then you upgrade each one of those tools every step up. It's like a, you know, an RPG game. You're like upping your character with some kind of new thing.
The speed controller, like the thing that just tells my machines how fast to go, is $800 upgrades.
Yeah.
Like I have a disc sander that I refurbished, I recycled an old motor and I used that old motor for a good 2 years before I was finally like, I need to upgrade this. And like I said, you know, it was a it was an $800 upgrade to that one tool to purchase a motor that can handle three phases, and then I had to get a three phase converter just to run that single tool. You know,
it's
one tool, and I use it for one thing.
And right. That's it. I think people have the misconception that it's like, okay, so I charge, or let's just say for simple math, we charge $500 for one of our products that we're making 20 of those products a day and just flowing them out like it's nothing. And that we're just stacking all this loot and we're, you know, putting a down payment on a yacht. Oh, that is, I'm putting all of my money into my business. And even right, yet, yeah. It's still, you know, you don't make money until, and that's the reason why I want to scale, because I do want to make money. I would love to be able to train someone to do what I'm doing as far as the production goes, so that I could focus more of my energy on the artistic side of things and work with more, I mean, it sounds whatever, but like work with more celebrities like I have in the past, rappers or athletes and stuff like that, because that's what I want to do, right? Like, if we're given this life, you got to do what you want to do.
Right. I just, there's something to be said about being bespoke. I agree 100%, like custom handmade. Look at a good example in the knife world is Chris Reeve knives.
Yeah.
Right. So Chris, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's massive. Dude is like one of the biggest names in the knife game. And Chris Reeve hasn't made, I don't even know when, but he stopped making knives in like 2002. But Chris Reeve knives, the company, they are 2 years booked for a $500 folder that, you know, he scaled. Right. And he, I don't know what he did, but like, that's what I would want to do. I'd want to scale up to where the personal hand touch stuff by me is what's, you know, worth the big money. And then right. I can do whatever I want with that. And then I want to have a line to where I can offer it to the everyday man, you know, or
yeah.
woman.
Whoever. Yeah. Yeah. I think and that
I hope people don't think that that's a bad thing, but that's no. how you grow a business. You have to scale. Like, I can't survive making 10 knives every 6 weeks
and I think
pay my bills.
I think it's like bespoke makers, or you know, like makers in general, we consume ourselves so much what we think the client is going to think of us, but fuck them. I mean, sure, they pay our bills and whatever, but like that, I want to give them a good product, but I also want to be able to do this the rest of my life. And if I'm making one pair of $500 sandals every, you know, 3 or 4 days, break that down. I'm making less than minimum wage in a sweaty swamp box. Like, you know, you have to start making decisions for your life and your family and putting them first. And I think maybe a year ago, I would really be like, man, I hope people don't think that I'm selling out because I want to make a second line to actually start making money, because I want everyone to think that I'm this like artist and, you know, I'm all of these things, which I am, but I can't do those things if I don't make money. Like, that's the trade-off.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, that's how I ended up with these production knives that I'm doing. Like, I want to offer it at a smaller price point. I mean, I make money doing it. I like the margins on them aren't as near as good as like my handmade stuff, but I'm not putting near the time in it, so I'm not expecting to sell my production stuff at the same price point as my handmade stuff.
That's exactly how I feel, and it gives an opportunity for the people, like I said, to kind of double back to it. Like, it gives an opportunity for people that really can't afford, like myself, I can't afford a pair of sandals if I were to buy them from someone else that are making the same thing as me. But if there was a less expensive version, and I've gotten to know this person through social media and he answers all of my messages and we've developed a relationship and I want to support him or her, that whatever, you know what I mean? Then I still want to buy from them rather than going to Tilly's and buying a wallet or a pair of sandals or whatever, because that's what I want to do. You know, it's like the same thing. Somebody could go to Big Five and buy, you know, a $40 knife. Sure. And it would serve a purpose, yeah. And they would be able to open their Amazon boxes and do whatever it is that they need to do. But it's, yeah, it's all good. Well, hey, Wyatt, we're going to take a quick break. And then we're going to come back. I got a few more things and we'll just keep chatting. Is that cool with you?
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
All right. We'll be right back, guys. All right, a quick word from our sponsor. Drum roll, please. Yep, you guessed it. We have no sponsor for this episode. So we might as well sponsor the episode for ourselves. If you're listening to this, go ahead and go over to Instagram and check out 21grams_leathergoods. Back to your unpaid regular scheduled programming. What's up, guys? Welcome back to 21 Gram Speaks. We're here with my friend Wyatt, and we're just kind of discussing, well, whatever we want to discuss. So right now we're talking about pricing and how we set our pricing and, you know, the conversations we have to have with clients sometimes to justify our pricing. And yeah, man. So, you know, we're kind of just discussing that. Is there anything else you can think to add to that?
Yeah, I think that, I don't know, like I said, pricing is a very hard thing for some people to wrap their heads around, not just client side, but also as the maker themselves, you know. And I understand, like, I see people who have priced themselves so cheap that it's almost like I don't understand how they can afford to do it at their level. And then I see people who are insanely priced and they wonder why they can't sell a knife, you know. I think there's a happy middle ground, and I, or not just knife, like also leather products, whatever. I think there's a happy middle ground, and you have to find that middle ground with your demand for your products. And yeah, it's basically what it is. It's your demand. Like, what can you, like, what's your demand and what's your output, right? If I was outputting 20 knives a month, I could probably, you know, lower it a little bit maybe to offset, because yeah, I'm putting more time into it.
Right.
But like I said, it's a hard balance, and like finding it, I think, is difficult for some people to get their heads around.
Yeah, it's tricky. I run into this problem all of the time. All of my business comes within 2 or 3, maybe 5 days after a viral video. So if I have a video that hits, because all of my business comes from vertical short form video, whether that's TikTok, Instagram, or Facebook, and a video goes off on one of those platforms, then I get hundreds and hundreds of messages or emails a day that I just get no title or no subject for the email, just the body of the email says, how much? And I'm like, for what? Like, give me some more,
yeah, right?
Give me a little bit more to work with. Or I get people that are
emails. I'm like, yeah. Oh, what are you talking about?
It's hard to deal with that kind of stuff and filter it. But what I've done to kind of gauge my pricing is, once I get to a waiting list that is 6 months or longer, 6 months out or longer, that's when I raise my prices. So my, like, custom carved and tooled sandal started at $300. Then my waiting list hit 6 months, and then I moved it to 400. Now it's at 500. And that way I can say no to a lot of people, which is better for, it's actually better for business, because I can focus more time on each one of those instead of feeling the pressure of like having a year long wait.
Right.
You know what I mean? I can charge more. It takes me roughly the same amount of time. But it also filters out a lot of the, you know, the tire kicking window shoppers. And that's the part that I have the hardest of spending. You know, if I start work at 5 a.m., I finish at 6 p.m., that's whatever, 13-hour workday. And then I come answer emails for X amount of hours a day. Oh,
yeah. It never stops.
It never stops.
The messages, and like, yeah, I'm not even that big. Like, I think I have 3,500 followers on Instagram.
Yeah.
Like, that's like my primary source of my business is Instagram. And I still have a ton of messages from people, or, you know, previous clients are hitting me up about stuff, or, you know, whatever it is. I don't want to say overwhelming, because it's just a part of it, but it's a big part of it. It's a big part of the job, is the talking to people and, answering emails.
It's such a huge part of it. And that's why I'm always like, There's some of the ones that I get, and you probably get these too, like the sob stories where this is how it goes. I'll just paint the picture. Somebody reaches out and they're like, "Hey, I want to get a pair of, let's just use an example. I did like a Batman and Robin pair of sandals." And it's always when I do something, then everyone wants that exact thing. And they think that it's like that product is still available, which it's already sold because I work hands-on with each person. So I explain that
Remember
to
what I
them.
was saying about I'll post a knife that I finished 2 months ago. I'll get a
Yeah.
message like, "Hey man, how much for that knife?" I'm like, "Oh, it's already gone."
Yeah,
But
it's I can make you one like that. That's what I always tell people, and I explain to them the process that it's like a collaborative process, and I work with you hands on, and I take a 50% non-refundable deposit, all of these things. But so I start working on like this pattern of these conversations to wean out the people, and then I tell them the price, which is so hard. Like, I don't know why it is. I just say it, and I walk away. If they bite, they bite. If not, they just ghost me and I don't hear from them. And that's a lot better. Or some people will be like, "Oh my God, that's so expensive." I'm like, "Dude, I totally get it. It is expensive." I just agree with them. And I tell them, when you
I
get your
always hit
money
it. Yeah,
right.
that's what I say too. I always hit them with the, "Yep, I agree with you. It is."
Yeah, it is
And
expensive.
they're not wrong. Like, I make expensive stuff.
Yeah, I mean, could you do it cheaper? Sure, but you wouldn't be able to even afford your tools or your materials in order to do
Oh my
it.
God, yeah. I just ordered steel the other day, and it was $1,000.
Yeah, that's how, I mean, I'm really fortunate because
Just for the raw material. You know?
I've kind of gamed the system, and I put a lot of work into getting sponsorships. So a big portion of work for me is also reaching out to companies, whether it's like I have a full leather sponsor, a company, the leather company, where I just put an order in once a month or whatever for all the leather that I need, and they just ship it out to me, which is
Oh, that's dope.
thousands and thousands of dollars. And I love them. They always take good care of me. If they get new products, they send it, and I just tag them,
Awesome.
and we work really well together. And it's
I'm
been
about to call Pittsburgh and tell them I need some steel.
yeah, exactly. Or I work with, I'm real fortunate that I've developed really good, relationships with Ian from OA Leather, or working with Weaver, or these different companies, and I'll put together a video that they're able to use. We do a collaboration. They send me the tools. I put out a video that they're able to use, but I keep those tools and I use them for more and more videos. People will message me, "Hey, where did you get that?" "Here, you can get it here. Here's my affiliate code." So that helps me out, but that in itself is a job. You have to write proposals
Yeah,
to all
there's
of these
stuff
companies.
that
Like,
goes into that. Yeah,
yeah, it's
it's
not
not just
like,
like,
yeah,
on.
it's not, it's just, it's not as easy as people think. And, I've been, it's so much a part of my business that I teach courses to people via Zoom, how to seek sponsorships and how to negotiate. Well, you can negotiate with any company you can negotiate to bring down prices. But that goes back to the beginning of this conversation, in the sense that you need to build a big following on social media. And
Right.
when I propose these proposals, and I'm like, "Hey, I have a quarter million followers on TikTok. I got 13,000 followers here and 100,000 followers on Facebook." And this isn't a brag. It's the effort and the amount of work that goes into it. It's not like
Yeah.
you wake up, right? Wyatt, you didn't wake up one day and you're like, "Oh, I'm really good at making knives." It's a lot of hours that you didn't go to your friends' going away parties, a lot of time that you didn't spend with
Yeah.
your wife to hone a craft, and you're now getting the payoff for it.
Believe me, it's like the whole adage like we were talking about earlier. If anybody could do it, then everybody would be doing it type situation.
Right.
And like I said, my first probably 20 to 30 knives, they were like knife shaped objects that I was selling to my buddies for like $20 and like $40
Knife
and
shaped objects. I
whatever.
love it.
Yeah, that's what they were. I mean, nowadays, I'm using the latest Magna Cut steel. And I'm doing like very precise heat treatments, and I do cryogenic processing on these things, to like give
Right.
like the best quality I can give,
Yeah.
But then, that just goes into with like learning it. And like that was a very steep That was a very steep hill to climb with just learning how to do it.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that people don't
Especially
take
by
into
yourself.
consideration. Yeah, and
No
yeah,
classes. I learned it all from
same.
YouTube and Reddit posts and,
I
reaching out and
literally just
hopefully this
I
ice
just taught
maker is.
myself how to make shoes, and that's a whole. I mean, I'm
Oh, they look
saying,
super sick also. They look
thanks.
really good.
I get to make another pair next week. I get excited when I look at my like order list, and I'm like, boots, they're coming up. Like, and then I chip away at like three projects, and I'm like, two more projects, two, and I get so excited. But I think what I was gonna say is what a lot of people don't understand is there's a lot of cost that goes into the cost that you sell. So all of that steel that you messed up, all of the wood that you messed up, all of the material cost that you, for lack of better terms, wasted, but it was a cost for your education. That's what people
Yeah.
don't take into consideration. It's expensive to learn a craft at where you're at.
I probably have $1,000 of Damascus that looks like a banana hanging on my wall from
Yeah.
knives that was just like I heat treated wrong and it warped so bad that I couldn't save it.
Yeah.
I get like I have thrown away several hundreds of dollars of steel from it cracking in heat treat because I did it wrong or whatever. I ground it too thin, and then cooling a knife from 1600 degrees down to below 115 seconds is very stressful on steel. If you
Sure.
do it wrong, it's actually like the most stressful part of knife making. It's actually the heat treat part. But if you
And
do
it's
it
like
wrong,
towards the end, right?
well, it's after. So a lot of a lot of work goes into like profiling and getting the shapes perfect and like whatever, right? And
Sure.
it's still a long way from the finished product, but it's far enough along to where you don't want to mess it up because it's gonna suck to start over.
I mean, I think that the reason why I'm so able to talk to, whether it's knife makers or, people that just do different kind of making crafts, is that they're so similar. I mean, there's been times that I'm at the very last end of a process on something. I'll give you an example. So one of the first, I don't know, six, seven pairs of shoes slash boots that I made, you have to nail the midsole to the last. The last is like the foot form, the blue like thing that you build the whole shoe around. You nail the midsole and then you build the whole shoe around that. If you don't take those nails out at the perfect, at a time you build the whole shoe around it, you can't get the last out. So you're like, you have to cut the shoe off of the last, and it's the last thing when you pop them off, the last out of the shoe. If the nails are still in there, you're like, oh my God, I just spent a week making these. It's like the most devastating thing that you could imagine. And I kept it up in my shop to remind me, like, don't forget to take these nails
Yeah,
out.
that's why I got a wall of, well, not in here, but I got a wall of shame in my garage. It's like all my failed projects. I'm like, oh man.
You need to have that. It keeps you
It's
humble and it
heartbreaking.
reminds you. It is heartbreaking, but I have an entire huge like tote box, storage tote box full of wallets and projects that I've messed up. And it keeps me on those days that I think that my shit doesn't stink. Like, no, you've messed up a lot. You've messed up a whole lot. And it's good to kind of keep you there. And it's always good to have these reminders that we're just people, man. It doesn't really matter what it is. And that kind of leads to the other part of this conversation that I kind of want to steer into is, first, how long have you had your knife business, where it's become from a hobby to a business? And that's going to lead into, like, what are some of the lessons that you learned from the beginning to where you are today, Wyatt? Like, some of the things that you might be able to share with people, mistakes you've
How
made,
much
things you've learned.
time do we have?
As long as you want, brother.
Oh my gosh. Oh, dude. Yeah. So I officially became a business, like officially, at the very end of 2021. So from my first knife ever, at the tail end of 2018, beginning of 2019 to 2021, I was not a business. I was a hobby.
Right.
And basically those first 2 years, I dedicated like an unbearable amount of time to it and building my shop. And, you know, and I thought I was smarter than the guy on YouTube who's been doing this for 20 years. And I was like, right. Oh, I could do that.
Shortcut that.
With this other tool.
Yeah.
And I mean, if I'm being honest, I wasted a ton of money. And I think this was like the biggest takeaway. Like, and I hate to say it, like, because every old timer in the world that's listening to this or ever hears this audio is going to be like, I fucking told you, right? Like the whole buy once, cry once mantra, I really lean into, because if I think about it, right, I bought a $120 grinder, and then I upgraded it to a $400 grinder, and then I upgraded it to a $700 grinder, and then right. I finally upgraded that to a $1,600 grinder that I've upgraded over the time then to turn into a $4,000 grinder.
Right.
But you got to think like that 700, that 400, that 120.
So expensive.
Like, that's already $1,000 in grinders that I just throw away. Like I'm not even right. using one. Like I right. literally gave one to my buddy. I was like, hey, just want this.
Yeah.
But like that whole, you know, building your shop with like the right tools was a huge lesson for me, because like I said, I was smarter than everybody else who's been doing this for a very long time.
And that's, I think we all suffer from that. I can say the exact same thing. And I love the mantra, like buy one, cry one, buy once, cry once. I just, you know.
And I understand like tools are expensive. Believe me, I know tools are expensive. And if you can just find the funding to like save up a little at a time, and you get the right machine for the job, I highly recommend you do that, or try to do it at least. Like that was like a huge lesson. Like I said, I've wasted thousands of dollars on tools that just do not do what I need them to do for this business.
My theory with all of this too, with the buy once, cry once, I take a little bit of a different approach. There's so many different tools that leathersmiths can use. I'm sure just the same way as knife makers, there's so many different versions of tools that you can use. For me, I will buy the cheapest version of a new tool. So if it's the difference between using like a crescent type of punch for stitching or like a hole punch for stitching, I'll buy the cheapest version of each one of those tools, or a style of knife. If it's like a Japanese skivey knife, or like a safety knife or a utility knife, like I'll buy the cheapest version and see if it's something that I'm going to use for more than 6 months and get like into it. Then I immediately buy, if I have the money or I save up, for the best version. And that's even to sewing machines, where
that's a good way of doing it.
Yeah, because otherwise I would buy the best tool of everything that I've ever tried to do. And that's also not a good thing. Like like even with the sewing machine that I had, like I started off with like a hand crank cub machine from Weaver, which was great when I had it. But then I realized it wasn't the right tool for the job I needed. And I sent that back. They're awesome. Thank you, Weaver, if you're listening to this. And I ended up replacing it with a Texo, like, you know, motorized machine that does like shoe like uppers properly, and like what the tool I needed. And now I have
like
the
like tool I need. Machine.
Yeah. Proper like post bed sewing machine. That's for shoe uppers.
So
crazy. So industrial sewing machines are no joke. Like it's insane. And the whole ordering process, and then a huge truck coming to your house and putting it together. It's not like you're not going to Joanne's, you know, fabric to go pick up a Singer. Yeah. Like this is a whole day.
Hey, you don't have a sewing together. Machine at Joanne's that can sew three pieces of 8 ounce leather together, you know?
No. And that's the thing that because I really want to get like a, you know, a portable walking. I only have so much room in my shop. So I'm looking, and I don't have any more room for like a full sewing machine that comes with like a, you know, sewing table and all of that stuff. So I just want to get a portable walking foot machine. And so I think I'm going to get that sale right. I always set one goal for a new big tool for my shop every year. So next year I'm gonna get a new like flatbed
Yeah, I do the same thing. Like this year,
You got
I
to.
want to get a, I want to get a CNC machine, so I can rough out handles while I'm doing other stuff.
Yeah.
So,
Those are
yeah.
big. Those are big. You must have a really big garage.
It's a two car,
Yeah.
so it's getting a little full, and I'm having to like get creative with
Yeah.
some shelving. But I think I
Tetris.
can make it fit. Yeah, I'm playing
Yeah.
Tetris like right now. My wife hates it. She has to
Yeah.
like duck, dick, dodge, and duck all my
Yeah.
tools and stuff coming in like into the house every day.
We I something I do. I mean, this is kind of, this is another thing I wanted to discuss with you is like burnout. But one of the ways that I handle burnout is just going on vacation where I have no cell phone service, whatever. We did that last week. Me and my wife went on a cruise to Mexico, which I know is like old person vacationing, but whatever. Judge us all you want. It's what we like to do. And
Better than
so we
my
went.
cruises.
They're awesome. I love them. But
In the
we.
Navy, we call going on cruise going on deployment.
Oh,
So,
yeah.
like, oh, we're going
There
on
you
cruise, you go on
go.
deployment, you're stuck on a battleship for the next 7 months.
Totally different. Totally different. So I respect that. So we anyways, we went for a week, but before I leave on any kind of vacation, I spend an entire day in my shop taking everything out of every single drawer that I have, reorganizing and filling a tote thing with tools that I no longer use or like materials I don't use. And then I wipe down every surface like a crazy person. Like I go full blown like tweaker in there for a whole day so that when I come back and I've started missing what I do, my workspace, doing leather craft, and I'm excited to get back to work, I come to a sparkling clean shop. And that's something that is
That's
so
so important.
valuable. It's
That's
so
so
bad.
important.
Yeah, it's one of those things. That's something I wish I would have done at the beginning. I mean, there's so many things that I've learned along the way of owning a business. One of the things
Oh, yeah.
is it takes time. Like, you're not going to be able to build an empire in a year. Like, you just got to keep showing up every single day. And there's times where you feel like, oh my God, I'm going to have to go get a real job. And then you get a, 6 months worth of orders in and you're able to pay your
I was like, oh my
bills
God, I
and
have to keep my real job.
Yeah, well, you probably get paid too much at your job to quit it.
it's not bad. I wish it was more, honestly, but yeah,
Who
it's not too
doesn't?
terrible. For what I do, I think I get, there's some days where I think I'm underpaid. There's some days where I think I'm overpaid. It's just with anything. Like
What?
when I'm having
Yeah.
like, oh, like I'm having like a week at work, I'm like, I do not get paid enough for this. This is ridiculous. And then there's other days where I, like we got nothing going on. No foreign countries made us mad, so we're just kind
Yeah.
of hanging out. And we're like, all right.
That is crazy. I would love to talk to you about foreign policy and geopolitics if you ever
Oh,
want to have that conversation.
I'm a real pirate, man. I broke maritime law on my last deployment.
Oh, hell yeah, I like that. That's crazy. Are you legally
It's
allowed to
sketchy at
talk
the
about
moment.
that stuff?
Yeah, I don't see why not. It's basically I incited violence against a foreign nation.
Oh, awesome. Tell me more.
Yeah. So, long story short, we have this thing in the Navy called sweepers.
Okay.
And it's every day at 7 a.m. and at 2 p.m. or 1400, you sweep the ship. So, you get brooms out and you clean up all the dust. It's crazy how much dirt is in the middle of the ocean. You would not
Yeah.
believe it.
Yeah, that is weird.
And I don't know, when you're like 5 months into a deployment, especially like a COVID cruise where all the ports have been shut down and you're not allowed
Yeah.
on the ship, you get
Weird.
kind of bored.
Yeah.
And so we were trailing this foreign ship, I'm not gonna say the countries,
Sure.
and we were operating in their backyard, and we were basically projecting power, like, hey, we're the US, we do it like whatever the fuck we want.
Right.
And we're basically like, giving them the middle finger. And we're out there, and we got surrounded by 17 ships. Like, I woke up that morning, I went upstairs to, the hangar bay, called off sweepers, we're sweeping, whatever. We open up the hangar bay, and I look outside, and everywhere you see is just a foreign nation's ship everywhere. And it's just
Wow.
us, our one little US ship. And so, me being at sea for 5 months, I'm bored. started shaking my broom like a sand person from Star Wars, you know, at like these foreign national ships. And
you could have popped off World War III, but just by yourself.
Yeah, just being an asshole in the middle of the ocean, just shaking my broom at somebody's boat.
You got in trouble for that, though, huh?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
They did not appreciate it. Not the foreigns, our own people did not
appreciate it. Oh, yeah, of course. That makes sense.
Like, hey, fuckface, we're surrounded.
Yeah. Did you think you were going to die?
No, absolutely not.
Is there ever any time that you're out to sea that it gets really, really bad weather that you, like...
Yeah,
you get scared.
So I was doing we have this thing called hangar watch where you're basically like a rover where you just make sure things are good and like things aren't falling off the walls and
right
your aircraft doesn't tip over in the middle of the ocean. And I was sitting in a lawn chair in a hangar bay, a small hangar bay. I could see all three of our aircraft. I was like, all right, this is where I'm gonna hang out. And this is actually off the coast of San Diego, really rough waters off the coast of California.
Super really rough.
Yeah, it's really bad out there. And I'm sitting there. It's in the middle of a storm that started to roll in, so the waves are getting all crazy. I'm, like, rocking back and forth. And then this one, like, you go super far forward. And you're like, oh, man, this is weird. And then we went really far back. And, like, we rocked super far back. I was, like, suspended in the air for a second. I was like, this is going to fucking suck. And the ship slammed down into the water because we caught, like, a huge wave.
Right.
Slammed down, all the lockers blew open that were next to me because like they weren't locked properly or whatever. Like shit right. started falling off of the walls. Shit just went everywhere. The aircraft tilted and then it got slung back. Like it was crazy. I was like up there by myself too. I was like, what the fuck? Like our
That's
office
scary.
Was a complete wreck. Like that was like the only time I was like, this is it, I'm gonna die. In that moment where I was suspended in the air, I was like, yep, here it comes. Just slammed down. So like the whole like sea legs thing is like very real. Like, I was off the coast of Malaysia one time.
Yeah,
we were getting like I don't know why, but we anchored in like the worst spot ever.
Yeah,
and we were just getting our shit rocked, and like we were like walking on the walls because like
really
you would list
tilt
so
that
bad.
Much.
You would tilt so much. Roll is what we call it. You would roll so much that you're like walking like side to side. You know, as you're going down like the hallways. Like you like end up like getting like a foot on the wall to like stop yourself from falling over. So
you say that with a big old grin on your face, but there has to be some
fun.
Kind of.
I love it.
Oh God.
I love being out at sea. I love going out there. I love
being. You kind of have to, right? Or you wouldn't last.
Yeah, you gotta find the joy in it. And I think a lot of people get really hung up on the negatives of being in the military.
Yeah.
When I have made the best friends of my life. I have been to 22 countries. I've spent a month in Tokyo. I don't know. I work on a $53 million machine every day.
And it's cool. It's exciting.
Cool. It's very cool. And, you know, and like I'll go home. I'm from a small town in Texas. Like
okay.
Very sticks like 1,500 people in my
home. Okay.
And like I'll go home for like Christmas, whatever. And like I'm almost 30. You know, I'm 27. And like I have friends who have just never left.
Sad.
They're just still there. And like I used to work in the local grocery store. Like people that worked with me there
still work there
are still working there. It's crazy.
Do you find it hard when you do go back to your small town to have conversations with those people? And I know for myself the reason why I say that is because I've been able to travel a bunch too, and I can tell pretty much almost right away if people have traveled. They seem to be a lot kinder to people, a lot more progressive minded, and a lot more understanding of different cultures, right? You've spent time in other people's houses. You realize, I always say you don't really meet a lot of racist world travelers. Doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? Because you get to know people from different.
Being in the military, you have like the strangest friend groups. Like it's so weird. Like one of my homies is like, you know, black guy from inner city who grew up pretty rough. I'm like a country kid from the middle of Texas. And we got like we got a a Latin dude from LA who's like, you know, like very much into like the California scene. Like we're all from right. like very different backgrounds, and then like we're all just like hanging out at like the bar, just chilling. Like it's like whatever, you know.
Friends. Like, yeah.
Yeah, you're super cool. And like we're from completely different backgrounds. And,
got to find something common with those people. But when you do go back to Texas to your small town and you see those people that never left the small town, do you find it difficult to have meaningful conversations? Like a friend that you went to high school with that still thinks he's the star athlete. And you know what I mean? Like that stereotype of people that, you know, never leave their town.
My actual friends from high school are all very, most of them are very like put together and like normal. So like, no, I don't have any issues with that, but like, I don't know. I haven't really had a bad experience like going home and then like talking to people from my hometown. So I don't have any issues with it, but I also, you know, I spent half of my life there. So
yeah,
it's whatever. It's not like I go home and I don't know. It's just, it's normal to me.
I don't stay home very long.
Yeah.
That's probably a thing too. Is your family still lives there?
Yeah, my family is one of the original families in the town. Like my great 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 grandfather like settled it in like 1860s.
Oh wow. So you're like a celebrity there.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that we're just a well-known family.
Yeah.
Because our I don't know. Yeah,
because your great great grandfather settled it.
Because we've been there since the 1860s.
Yeah.
So, like everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows who the Springfields are. You know, it's like
the Springfields.
My last name's Cutchin, but I'm a part of that's my dad's side. My mother's side is the small town family.
The
my
heroes.
Dad's from Fresno.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of like a mini Texas up there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
it's crazy. If you go to like NorCal, if you go to like, like a Pleasanton, Tracy area, it's like very Western, and like there's like rodeos all the time. Like,
it's weird. There's these little pockets. Like even where I live in the Inland Empire, and there's a town here called it's horrible here, but I mean it is what it is. It's no different than anywhere else. It's your mindset, I guess. But there's a little town called Norco, which is, it's called like Horsetown, USA, and it's like middle America. You drive like down one street and all of a sudden there's like horse trails on both sides of the street. The road is painted red, white, and blue, and you know, there's Trump flags everywhere, and you're like, what the, like, it's just, you make one turn and all of a sudden you're in this area. Yeah. And it's,
so it's kind of like where I live in San Diego. It's like very right leaning and there's like horses everywhere. Like, that's kind of the same thing.
It's weird how there's just these little pockets, and I appreciate it. It's awesome to drive through there, seeing all the horses, and it's hot here right now, but I need to like always do. I have a Belgian Malinois dog, and she is just, she has, her lifestyle is two full-time jobs to like even be able to handle. Like she's either at 100% or asleep. Like there's no middle ground. So one of the things that I do to kind of like exercise her mind is I'll just drive through that town Norco, and she sees all the horses and people walking and the smell of like horses, and she's constantly just looking at everything. But it's a cool experience to live that close, and there's rad hiking trails, and it's rad. It's really cool to be able to live that close. And it's just a different, like I grew up very much like city slicker. Like I'm not a country guy. Like I've never,
exact opposites.
Yeah. I've never woken up to a rooster. I've never ridden a horse, and I've never milked a cow or anything like that. So that's one of the things
out of other cows.
Oh gosh. All the way up to your elbow. That's insane. Yeah. I just, shoulder. So even like, oh my God, the leathercraft world is so full of people not like me. You know what I mean? Like, it's weird how I just kind of fell into this, and
I feel like the knife making community is like, they're all very much kind of like me. Like,
yeah.
We're all a bunch of like small town guys, and
I don't know. It's It's wild. Well, hey, Wyatt, we're going to wind down. I was going to say Wyatt down. Is there any advice that you would give to somebody that's kind of making that, taking that next step from the hobby into moving into starting to sell products? Would you give anybody some advice? You know, maybe there's somebody listening that could be inspired by you kind of making that transition.
I have two things. One, don't do it. It's too time consuming.
Stick to your 9 to 5.
I think you really need to find what makes your product. It's very cliche to say, like, you get a defining look in your product. And then I think that you really need to focus on marketing yourself. Like, that is such a huge thing. Like, you need to learn how to do photography. I'll tell you right now, people buy pictures, especially if you're an online based seller. People buy photos. And, yeah, you know, you really need to work on that. And the same thing if you're doing like knives, for instance, I could just say this, the handle will sell the knife every time. So focus on turning something into something beautiful. Anybody can make a knife that's sharp. You want to make it something that's unique. So find something that makes it unique to you. Like, I have a very unique thing of mine. I do texturing on my blades that not a lot of people do.
Yeah.
And then work on your marketing. That is massive. Photography, marketing, just, you know, yeah, I'm not saying be on social media all the time, because I'm not. I post once a week, maybe.
Yeah.
Once a week if I'm feeling froggy.
Yeah.
Just whatever you put out, make sure it's quality.
That's super great advice. And I think that the one thing that specific that kind of stood out to me in that, and the advice that I always give people, is find something that sets you apart. There was, at the beginning of what I was doing, I just did what everyone else was doing, and I didn't get no glances my way. Then I kind of found my niche with the, like, tooling the tattoo style and painting, like, in the traditional tattoo style. And then it blew up overnight, and I was able to do that. I think not just stopping at photography, but learning how to do short form video in a video. World of, you know, TikTok, just, you got to do it. It just is what it is.
You have to.
All right. And,
Wyatt, you know, I'm still working on that.
I appreciate you coming on, and I enjoy this time. I hope you'll come back on in a couple months, and we'll catch up. It's just, like I said, it's just conversation. So we'll chill out. I appreciate you, and everyone that's listening to this, I hope you guys like the first episode of season 2. This is the way it's going to go. Just lighthearted conversations and no filters. We're just going to do it. So until next week, we appreciate you, and see you later.